Welcome to Conversations in MedEd, the people behind the research. Hi, Avita. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Nikki. Thank you for having me.
Such a pleasure. Could you just introduce yourself to our listeners? So who are you? Where are you based? What do you do?
Yes, of course. So my name is Avita. My full name is Avita Rath. I'm a dentist by my profession, a periodontist to those who are acquainted with dentistry. I'm currently based in Malaysia. I work in a private university at a dental faculty. I'm a senior lecturer here. I am a consultant, and I'm from India. I'm an Indian by my nationality. Been in Malaysia for the last 9 years, I believe. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm bad with counting. So that's that. I've worked in India for a few years after I finished my postgrad, and I got an opportunity to explore Southeast Asia. Never been to this side of the world, even though I'm from Asia myself. I thought, okay, let's just explore this side, and I've been here ever since then. Yeah.
Great. And so how does a dentist get involved in medical education? What was your journey into sort of going into research and education more generally?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking that question. I know it's, I believe it's a very cliche question, but that usually I don't get this question. Nobody has asked me this question. They usually ask me, why did you join dentistry? For me, I think I know this will be a very cliche answer, but it's true. I love teaching. I'm an elder sister. I'm the elder sibling. So I love teaching, although it's different that my younger siblings don't listen to me. That's a different thing. I always had a knack to explain to my juniors. And I just loved, you know, being the one who kind of imparts the knowledge. I thought I had the right kind of knowledge to share. So even when I was an undergrad, I had juniors. Because I used to stay in a hostel, because I studied in a different state in India from where I come from. It's different from where I come from. Yeah. I was in hostel. So when you are in a hostel, with other residents, you know, you just tend to be, I don't know, you tend to get more interactions with seniors and juniors and your peers. So, yeah, I mean, that's how I love teaching. I mean, I never thought I would go into education, but I kind of enjoyed explaining frameworks or anything pertaining to dentistry. And it kind of reinforced, I think the best way to test your own knowledge is to, you know, teach someone else. And that's what I felt, because when someone asked me and I couldn't explain, I would be like, oh God, I need to go back and clear my basics. That's how it happened. And then somehow landed up doing my postgrad from the same institution I did my undergrad. And there, of course, there was a mandatory teaching. You had a teaching. You needed to teach. I mean, other than, we had to teach the undergrads when we were postgrads. And I kind of enjoyed it, because I chose a subject that not many dental undergrads, I mean, my subject per se, my discipline per se is quite ambiguous. It's always a gray area. Everybody keeps fighting. One periodontist keeps fighting with another one. I think it's the same throughout other health professions, if I'm not mistaken. And so the fact of clarifying those concepts, especially when you are a postgrad, you know, you kind of feel like, oh, I'm a doctor now. You know, I can share what I didn't know or what I couldn't experience as a student. Mm-hmm. The kind of teaching I wanted from my my teachers. Of course, some of them were amazing, but I came from a very teacher-centric setup. Where students were, I mean, it was our problem, whatever it was. So when I became a postgrad, I kind of realized that, no, it's not really always the student's problem. It's everyone's problem if someone is not able to understand something. So yeah, that's how I entered into education. I realized that, oh, I would like to be an academic. And that's where I immediately stepped into academia. But I was not a formal academic until just now when I completed my master's from Edinburgh in health professional education, because there were many aspects. I don't know. I mean, I know I had an innate, organic sense, intuition that something is not right here, especially when it came to teaching and learning and assessment. And it was more organic in the sense it was very vicarious what mm-hmm. I learned from my seniors or my teachers or didn't learn from them. Yeah. And I wanted to share that with my students. But when it came to the formalities or the formalization of things, I struggled a lot. And actually, my real growth has happened here in Malaysia, because the first 3 years as academic staff, I was still a junior. Mm-hmm. I was still a ECR, or you can say just ECA. And, you know, usually they always dump all the, I don't know, you do all the groundwork and yeah. all the cleaning, the dirty work from all your seniors. It's always like that. And then I kind of learned a lot in that process. And when I came here, the system was kind of different. The curriculum, the teaching and learning, everything. So it was really a learning journey for me. But I would say I became an educationist, not because I got a formal degree from a university, but I could label, you know, I could put it into frameworks and concepts. I know it's it's human to label things, right? So when you have something evidence-based when you're talking about, you kind of feel a little less imposter.
Yeah.
So yeah, my education journey was very organic. It was just how life unfolded and my interest unfolded. But I never thought of taking a formal degree in health professional education per se until COVID struck and I was stuck, you know, in a quarantine. So I was like, okay, might as well do something with my life. Even then I was like, oh, whatever, I'm getting a free degree, might as well do it. I've shared this even with my supervisor there. And I was like, well, I won't say that, oh, I was always, I mean, who doesn't want, that's the thing. I think it's a very Asian thing saying that, oh, who doesn't want a degree from UK?
Yeah.
Right. So that's what. And I got a scholarship. I was like, oh, why not? You know, I don't have to pay a penny. Might as well just sit. I just jumped in. And even then in the year one of my master's, I had a tough time. I mean, I was like, what are they talking? I mean, it's English, but I'm like, I can't get the head and tail of this. Why am I in the wrong place? Oh my God, can I just discontinue? Yeah, it was, I would not say it was always awe-inspiring. Yeah. I mean, at some point in my life, and it thought comes in that I shouldn't have been in academia or in education. Not because I hate teaching. I still do love teaching, just the teaching part alone. But there are so many other nuances that makes it like, oh, I don't know, why am I even here?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I think I kind of deviated from your question.
No, sorry. We'll definitely get into all those other aspects a little bit later. But yeah, I want to pick up on your comment on imposter. So I agree with you. I think especially starting a formal qualification is definitely overwhelming. And it's because you don't really understand what they're talking about. And it's the discourse or the language. And you feel like you belong when you finally have those words to tie things to. And so maybe reflecting on imposter syndrome, not just in academia, but within the field. As a dentist, how do you navigate being within, you know, med ed or health professions education?
That's an amazing question. And thank you for asking me, Nikki, because nobody has asked me. And I don't think anyone asks such questions, because when we talk about health profession education, I've seen this being now closely associated with the space. It's always a very catch-all phrase. And even though we know that every discipline is different from each other, there's a certain, I don't know, there's, as you mentioned earlier, there is a certain hierarchy. It's a very implicit bias, I would say. One thing for sure is, of course, when I'll just give my own experience example here. The cohort I was in was mostly filled up by NHS doctors and nurses. And usually they are the ones who generally delve into this field, I think, first, I would say. Yes, I would not deny there were a few dentists in the group, But it was very selected few, and it's not that I felt out as an outcast or somebody made me feel that way. It's just that it was very hard to understand those conversations they were sharing. I mean, it was amazing to hear their experiences and share mine too. But apart from being an Asian, in a first-time European education, not that, yeah, everybody made me feel welcome. So I would not say that it was them. It was always me, being an introvert. Just that the fact that I'm doing this with you, I was having like, I took 1,000 steps. And I was like, okay, now I'm going to just sit and relax and talk to you. Did I do the right thing? I should have just said, oh, I'm having a bad stomach or a flu. But yeah, it was scary. Maybe first thing is because it was online. And although we got acquainted with the online setup, it was not the online per se, but it's the fact that, you know, you're talking to, I don't know, there are 20 others. And yes, everybody, the facilitator makes you feel very comfortable and all that. But it's just the stories. I had nothing to say when they were sharing a very a story that majority could relate to, you see. So and I'm there's nothing wrong with that. There's uniqueness to every story. It's just that it's not that anybody makes you feel like an outcast. It's just like, you know, the imposter syndrome that creeps in. You know, you just don't feel, firstly, you don't feel that you feel like an imposter because you yourself have doubts that would I be a good educationist or an academic? Do I deserve to be here? The second thing is by the mere virtue of being in a profession that's not really well represented in the MedEd. So much as compared to, I mean, I've gone to two, I mean, this is going to be my third AME conference. I mean, I know three AME conferences are nothing, but even as an online, when I attended the conferences, I was a bit, it's not the topic or, you know, you can Google something if they're talking about some jargon or something more technical, you can always Google it, and nobody expects you to understand because you're not a medical professional or you're not a medical doctor. But there are a few things, I don't know, the nuances of the environment that you can't relate to. I don't know if it's because we are geographically apart or we come from different cultures, or I don't know if I was a medical doctor, I could relate better, maybe. But you kind of feel a bit less, and it's not, I don't think it's the course or the university or because I was talking to somebody who's in a just poles apart from me. I have felt the same kind of discrimination. I could say discrimination back in my institute when I was a student, when we had certain classes with the medical students as well. So you tend to, firstly, the medical doctors who are teaching us and them, we are always the others and they are the ones, you know. So, and secondly, they always feel like, oh, you're going to just, you know, read about head and neck, you know, you don't need to worry about rest of the body. I mean, that's such a wrong thing because in the end, we, dentistry, or I think any profession, looks at a very holistic way of treating patients or treating people. But yeah, that was what was then when I was a student. So I think that kind of formed a base in my head that, and my dad is a medical doctor himself. And he has once told me, I don't know what you guys do for, I mean, that was a very, I don't know if I should just pull out, put my dad under a bus like that. But yeah, I mean, because there it was an argument between a medical doctor and a dental doctor. When he spoke to me like that, I had to argue back. Maybe I could argue back because he is my dad. But I mean, that's the general mindset. Yeah. I don't know if today it's still true, but maybe because now I'm surrounded by a dental fraternity. So, it's not like I feel like an outcast. Yeah. But yeah, when you are in those in those peripheral spaces with other specialities, not that anyone says, oh, you're just a dentist. No, not like that. You feel like, oh, I don't have anything common with you. You know, I think education was the only thing common. Something would click because when someone says, oh, yeah, I get you, you know, I want to share something what Avita shared, and you feel good. You feel like, okay, there's a purpose for you to be there. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm a dentist. I, as a dentist, I personally, I personally feel a bit marginalized by the virtue of being a dentist. It's nothing to do with my gender or other identities that I carry.
Yeah, no, your comments definitely resonate with me, and I've seen it myself, and I'm not a healthcare worker myself. I was health adjacent and working in a lab as a cancer researcher.
Yeah.
But those phenomenon definitely resonate with my own experience. There's a lot we could go into, but I actually want to speak about one of your recent publications in medical education called When I Say Emotional Labor. That also really struck a chord with me when reading it in preparation for this podcast. So maybe
thank you.
What is emotional labor? And then we can go from there.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Nikki. That's really kind of you. The topic of emotional labor, it was quite recent for my experience. I mean, it's been there since 80s. It was maybe if I just break down the foundation, it was a term coined by American psychologist Arlie Hochschild. I came across that very organically again, thanks to my supervisor. So I had written an assignment on it in my year two of my master's, and it was on the current topics in clinical education. So I had to choose one topic, and I was like babbling around with my supervisor. I was like, oh, I feel this, and but I'm not able to express it, da 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 da. And she was just quietly listening to me. She just said, okay, I'm going to share one paper with you, just go through it. I was like, okay, fine. And then I opened it, and it was a very, I think it was 1976 paper of Hochschild, it was too long, and it was too, because she's a psychologist, I was like, I love reading psychology paper when you have all the time in the world. And I was like, oh my God, why did she share this with me? She has not really talked about the term as such, emotional labor, but she kind of gives a pretext before she shares it in her, you know, seminal work in the book, The Managed Heart. So basically, emotional labor is you manage your emotions in professional spaces in a way that conforms to the expectations of that professional space. Mm. Now, this is just my summary. It's not really dictionary definition that I'm giving, but I think people can just Google it, and there are beautiful definitions given by Hochschild and Grundy, and there are a lot of pioneer women researchers. Mm. If I could just focus on that, who I've come across, who have researched on it. So emotional labor is basically a kind of emotional regulation, you could say, which we do in our work environment, mm. as simple as it is. The term insinuated from research in human service professions, like your, I think the pioneering research was done on flight attendants and bank tellers. And now whenever I step into a flight and I look at a flight attendant, that's all I could think about. I do have respect for what they do, because that's really, it requires a lot of patience, dedication, and a lot of willpower to control when you want to bash someone up if someone is misbehaving. But when I read her book, I mean, it was only from there I started reading, and I started reading a lot of papers on emotional labor, which was done. I mean, much of the studies have been done in communication, social sciences, of course, psychology. Even general education, mostly K-12 teachers and so on and so forth. I realized that there were not much studies on health professional educators. I mean, there are just very few on nursing educators, but nothing on health professional education, so even for health professional adjacent people. So then I was like, well, that's interesting. I mean, there are things on nursing educators and doctors, I would say, but not on doctors who are educators or dentists who are educators. So that then I was like, wow, that's something. I mean, I couldn't believe there are no studies or research, because I was like, I'm not properly searching it, or I tried all the databases. And I realized that, well, there are blogs, there are beautiful written write-ups and experiences by a lot of people, but nothing per se, nothing specific on a discipline, let that be medicine or dentistry, in terms of academia. Mm. So that's when I was like, okay, I'm going to And that's what I felt. So whatever I was babbling to her that day for an hour, and I didn't know how to put it up in this formal terms, that's all. She just had to share that paper with me. And that's where my whole journey started until year three, where I was thinking of doing something else, and I ended up taking this as my dissertation topic. And I'm still working on that paper, but that was something I wanted to do, a qualitative study on the dental educators, basically my colleagues here. So because it's a master's, I wanted to just keep it as visible as possible, because I was being too ambitious, and my supervisor was like, just do it on your colleagues first and let's see how it unfolds. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, why not? Because nothing has been done yet. And why the topic is important, I feel, is we don't talk much about our emotions. I mean, and this is something I think there are a lot of other authors, like there was a recent paper by Rola Jawi. She had written a good paper on emotions and feedback among students. But we don't talk about emotional labor of academics. It feels like we just don't have emotions, or, you know, nobody cares about our emotions, or it's secondary to students. And I have personally experienced it here, where it's always about the patients, it's always about the students. And it's great. I mean, we are in a profession which is all about philanthropy and all that thing, and that's great. But it's always at the cost of your own feelings, you know. So yes, we do regulate our emotions. I think every human being regulates. When you are in a society, you can't just, well, there are people who can just show whatever they want to show, but mostly we do optimize our emotions, right? But when it comes to a work context, it's not just you're regulating emotions because, you know, you want to give the best to others. You're also regulating emotions because there is a certain pressure from the top down as well, which we again kind of redress it as our professionalism. And that's what I found. It's a very complicated it's a complicated phenomena when it comes to health professional education, because it kind of entwines and it gets entangled and messy with professional identity or professionalism. And second thing is, there is also a cultural aspect to it, something that I spoke in the recent paper. There's, of course, a gender aspect to it. They also found that, you know, it's always, emotional labor is always, the burden is always much more taken by the women, because we are in a patriarchal society. I think even for that matter, the paper that you have written on, when I say it's Global North and Global South, it speaks of the same thing. Education is patriarchal. We're still stuck, sadly, in the same dimension, majorly. So, women are always expected to be more warm and nice. I have personally experienced that students always run to me, even though there is a male counterpart, and not because he knows less than me. He may be my senior. He knows more than me. He has more publications than me. But they will come to you because they know you're approachable. And there, it's not that you're not firm. It's just that there's some implicit expectation. And that's what Hoshil found herself. And there are a lot of other authors who found that there is the implicit expectation. You get a higher evaluation if you have been nice. And perhaps I get a higher evaluation because I'm approachable. And I'm not approachable because, I don't know if I'm approachable because I'm a woman, because I'm approachable because I'm an Asian, or it's a combination of all. Because I feel, I don't know if I'm in the right place to say this, but I always feel there is always a very, the Asian culture gives a little more, it's very value-based, very collectivist, you can say. And there are a lot of other studies who have done that, something that I've shared in the paper as well, that we do come from a culture where values and emotions are always given a little more importance as compared to being objective. But having said that, at the same time, you give importance to those values or emotions, but at the same time, you need to optimize them as well, because you can't just be too emotional. So yeah, I mean, the emotional labor is sounds very I don't know, sounds very commonplace, sounds like it's hidden. It's just hidden in plain sight. That's why when I took the topic, I was like, so many research has already been done. I don't know why. what's so new about talking about it? But problem is, it's not talked enough. And that's what I saw. Because when I asked the question in my interview to my participants, they were like, I asked him, what do you feel this term means? And they were like, oh, labor means work, emotional work. And those terms do exist, but there's quite a bit of difference. And they were like, I don't know. Do I do emotional labor? I'm not sure about it. Don't you think this is how we should behave? We are doctors, you know, we are dentists. So it's those, it's that ingrained, I don't know. It's like, it's a habit, you know, it's like a, what body would say, it's a habitus that, you know, you have drawn, embodied around you, and you become so much, it becomes so much a part of you that you don't think it's a labor, but it does affect you. What I saw from my work is it takes a toll on your mental health. It takes a toll on your identity. It that's what has led to people kind of getting this detached from their self. It kind of creates a kind of depersonalization, you could say. And those studies, it's not that I found it in my study, but all the seminal work has found the same thing. And it's still, we don't talk about it a lot. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, thank you. No, thanks for sharing. It's super valuable. And I agree. It does seem very obvious. Like when I read the paper, so much it was like, yes. But then it is surprising that it's not being researched. So I'm very keen to hopefully read your upcoming publication on it. But you end the piece by giving some possible recommendations or solutions. So I thought that might be actually a nice way to also end this episode. So when considering emotional labor, yes, it's gendered and cultured, and we need to think about the individual, but also the systems and structures that they operate within. So what do you see as a potential sort of strategies that we can address or minimize or account for emotional labor within health professions education?
I think the first thing that's the most feasible and practical thing that I feel we could do is, in my opinion, would be talk about it. You know, talk about your emotions, and not like having a therapy talk or, you know, having a, I don't know. I mean, it's weird to do all that, but not like a checklist that you need to complete, you know, because I always, even when I was writing that section in the paper, I was not very happy with writing it, because in the end of the day, the moment you start giving some kind of implications for practice or a policy, it becomes more like a checklist, like, oh, you're going to make a policy change, you're going to institutional, it should be a systemic thing. Yes, it should be systemic, but I feel it only starts when you start talking about it. You know, you speak to your colleagues, you speak to your peers, you ask them how they are doing. I remember one of the participants, some of the participants who said that, well, it's been so many years, no one has ever asked me how do I feel. And that was something very emotional for me when I heard that. And it's not something they were saying to impress me, because I was like, oh, they're just saying it because they know me as the interviewer. Well, keeping that as a caveat, so many of them, and none of them, so many of them said it in different ways that no one has asked about it. I never thought about it in that way. So I believe it's all about reflecting on it at first, as the first step, you know, talk about it more, talk about informal spaces, talk about it like how we are talking about it now, as a podcast, as a webinar, as, because people listen when they are not involved. They're like, yeah, you know, they're right. You know, they're talking about it. And I can relate to it. I can resonate to it. The more you talk about it, the more it becomes normal to talk about it.
Yeah.
And I believe once you normalize it, I feel it's something like the more you, I think a similar tangent would be if you talk about, the more people talk about LGBTQ and, you know, inclusivity, the more they include it, the more it normalizes it. It should come to a point where it's just part of health professionals' growth, you know. It should not become like, oh, let's have a topic on emotional labor, let's put that in the curriculum, and you know, we'll have these many hours dedicated, credit hours dedicated to it. Because the moment you start, I don't know, you start putting it in a very explicit, in a box, then it becomes just a tick box exercise. Yeah. So I feel the more organically you talk about it, and I think this is where we can do that as individuals. You don't really need an institute to do that for you, because I feel everybody has enough agency to talk about it, have webinars, have podcasts. It's not like you are, you know, hurting anyone's sentiments or, you know, mistreating someone. And I believe the more you talk about it, the institutes will observe and, you know, notice it. I mean, they have to notice it, because that's how I feel a paradigm shift happens. Mm-hmm. You start talking about it more and more. You bring people, you call others, you ask them, do they know about it? What is it? I believe when Hoshil, I don't know, I mean, I've not interviewed Hoshil, but I believe when she, flight attendants were there forever. It was her who noticed it. I mean, and it was her who asked them how they feel. I used to see them. I used to feel bad for them, but I didn't care much about it. And I used to just say, thank you so much. And we walk out of the plane. We don't even look at them sometimes, and we just walk out of the plane. But it's just that, I don't know, just be a little more conscious and empathetic and talk about it. Mm. Because when you talk about it, someone may relate to it, and someone who has not, doesn't know but is facing it, there's a label to it, there's a name to it. Mm. And the more people talk about it, the more, I'm sure everybody goes through it. It's impossible you can say, oh, I've never done emotional labor. I don't know, maybe some, if they're a narcissist, they would feel that way. But I believe an average human who has their emotions in place does that at some point. So I think talking about it, and then because that is, I believe talking about it is itself a form of resistance. And then, yeah, maybe do proper formal research, because the more the topic is formally exposed in high rank journals, of course, people will notice it. And I think it insinuates from that. Those are the trailblazers. And after that, yeah, maybe have more inclusive policy. But I don't know, when it comes to policies and places, although I wrote them in my journal, I felt they were very, I don't know, very mechanical. That I'm being honest. When I wrote them, I was like, I don't know, because everything has a backlash to it.
Yeah.
Because that's how we brought student centricism. That's how we brought other things. And it becomes a tick box at the end of the day. I feel the more you talk about it and you want to do something about it and have these discussions with people, with your seniors or senior echelons who can do something about it. Problem is, there are so many other things that precede emotional labor, like your tenure, your job, your I don't know, your growth, the salary, the pay. So, you know, emotion always takes a back seat. So I believe we can just talk about it a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe that would, yeah.
Yeah. Kind Well, Avita, thank you so much for talking about it and for giving us language to put to a phenomenon that we all experience. And
thank you, Nikki.
I support everything you're saying. And thank you so much for kickstarting research on emotional labor in the field. I'm hoping to see this sort of explode everywhere. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Nikki.
Such a
thank
pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, Nikki. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Avita.
I am Danica Sims, your host and producer. Thank you for joining Conversations in MedEd. Hit subscribe and leave a review. I love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or questions or recommended guests, please get in contact with me. Contact details can be found in the show notes. Are you passionate about education? Are you interested in conducting educational research? Are you considering obtaining a formal qualification in health professions education? The University of Oxford offers a part-time, two-year master's in medical education through the Department of Education in partnership with the medical school. We introduce students to numerous topics, theory, and evidence from the field, and support them in conducting their own educational research project. For more details, visit the Department of Education webpage Links can be found in the show notes.